This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. Neil Gabler certainly qualifies as a person at the leading edge. And there's sort of a stereopticon going on here. How'd I do? Can we say that? I just did. Isn't it Bob Dylan who said, I said it, so it must be true? Neil Gabler as the culture critic observer, and Walt Disney as so very important to the American culture and that which then gets exported. Bill Russell?
Well, in that same context, there's the tinkerer and the animator. And then somewhere, it's almost as if it comes out of the blue. It turns out what he really wanted to do was produce live-action movies.
That's correct.
And I said, where did that come from? And I think part of it, of course, is the, realizing that he couldn't perfect, the economics at least, and ultimately nothing's perfect. But I said, what happened that all of a sudden this guy who is literally the avatar of animation in the world really wanted to make live-action movies?
Yes, he did. Of course, I think one of the reasons is because he loved the idea of photographic reality and creating, again, his own world on screen. And one of the things he admired about live-action movies is the range of emotion that they could elicit. And when he starts making Snow White, that is really the kind of engine of Snow White. Can we elicit the same range of emotions from animated characters that one can get from live-action characters?
As you say, drawings. Can drawings make people cry?
That's right. That is the question. In fact, not too many years earlier, the animators are sitting around and they're questioning, will people accept a voice emanating from drawings? So this is how far we've come by the time he releases Snow White in December 1937. Not only are people accepting a voice coming from a drawing, because after all, the reason that question was asked is, we know that people talk, but do drawings talk? But now in December 1937... when he releases Snow White, the moment of testing is when the dwarves are surrounding the bier of Snow White.
The bier being the platform on which her presumed to be dead body.
Yes, exactly.
We're not talking about the beverage.
No, we're talking B-I-E-R. And the audience has got to, at that moment, if the film is going to be successful, cry along with the dwarves. Or at least along with Grumpy, because Walt had ordained that only Grumpy would have a tear. He said that will really get him. He knew how powerful that would be, that the most stubborn and ornery of the dwarves is the one whose eyes mist up. And of course, at the premiere, that gala premiere, the audience just breaks down, and Walt and the animators, who are all in attendance, know they've got them. They've done something.
Clark Gable and Carole Lombard and the great actors.
Cecil B. DeMille and, the whole...
The great performers of the day.
That's right. Were there and they were responding to animated drawings, crying at animated drawings. So Walt had ultimately achieved what he wanted to achieve. It would have been easier to do so with live action film. And of course, he later goes into live action film partly out of necessity because... He started the live-action films in England because England, after the war, had withheld the profits that Walt had made in England and compelled those profits to be spent in England. So Walt had the choice of either opening an animation studio in England, which he wasn't about to do, or making live-action films in England with those profits, which is what he did do, and that led him ultimately to make live-action films even in the United States.
There's this
and they were
parallel.
Good movies.
Yes, they were good movies. Well done. And films that... created another kind of cottage industry for Walt Disney, which was the Boyhood Adventure.
There's the parallel universe to the Disney the artist is the real world.
Yes.
One of the reasons they didn't open an animation studio, they were having a terrible time making money doing animations because it was so bloody expensive because he wanted to do the things he wanted to do.
And he wouldn't cut corners.
In addition to the economics of this, which is a big piece of the, in some ways, the drama, the ongoing drama, there are a couple other things that seem to be pivotal. One, the depression, He didn't notice the Depression.
That would be the Great Depression.
He was actually, you know, doing probably better than, actually better before than and after.
That's absolutely true. So Depression was good for Walt Disney. Yep. The post-war period, which was good for everybody else, wasn't so good for Walt Disney.
And of course, the other, you know, as much later is the labor problems that,
yes.
that came up. And
that
I don't think
he inflicted on himself.
Well, I don't think they're unrelated. I mean, the real world and his fantasy world. In many ways, he did not have full contact with the real world. That was Roy's job,
right.
and he had missed the most salient, one of the most salient events of the 20th century, at least in this country and in Western Europe. Which was the Great Depression.
Well, for all intents and purposes, he misses the war as well. I tell the story in the book where he's designing the studio, the new studio in Burbank that he built with the profits from Snow White. And it's early – it's sometime in 1940, so the Americans have not entered the war yet. And Walt is playing with a model, and one of his animators asks, but, you know, how is the war going to affect this? And Walt says, what war? Walt was oblivious because he did live within his own world. But I think, you know – one of the things you said, Bill, that the real world and the fantasy world collide for Walt Disney, particularly with the strike in 1941. Because when Walt builds this new studio in Burbank, which he intends to be a worker's paradise, it will have every amenity possible. It will have, if you're an animator and you want to have a malted milk delivered to your animation table, you press a button and there will be a malted milk delivered to your animation table. If you want to go to a sauna bath and work out in a gym, there is a gym and a sauna on the top of the animation building. I mean, there was nothing that Walt overlooked. The slats in the awnings that could be adjusted for the light for the animators. Tunnels under the studio so that if it rained, they could still transport the drawings to the camera department to be photographed. There was nothing that he overlooked. But in the process
except.
Of creating, except human emotion. And what happened when he built that perfect studio is that he became increasingly distant from his employees. In building the animation building, Walt had even stratified the animation building so that his office and the story department was on the top floor, and then there would be a flow. This is how logically he had thought about it and routinized it. There would be a flow to the next floor where the layout artists and the background artists would work, and then there would be a flow to the animators on the first floor, and the camera was in the basement. So the work would flow down. But you see as well how he stratified everything. And in creating that stratification and in distancing himself on the third floor from the animators with whom he'd worked so closely, who are now on the first floor, Walt was creating the tensions and the rifts within his own company. And then when you add on top of that his paternalism, his hogging credit, and finally his refusal to accept the recognition of a union because he could not understand, having created this worker's paradise, why anyone would need a union. All of these things created the incipient situation for a strike to occur, and it did in May of 1941.
He was also a lousy manager.
And terrible
that,
manager.
And in that context, and he, not only was he a lousy manager, but he wouldn't let anybody else manage.
Well, that's why he was a lousy manager in a way.
Right. But when you throw that into this mix, and you have to in the way you sympathize with him, he thought he had created, and it's not by accident, this is a worker's paradise.
Exactly.
Straight out of Marxism.
Right.
Which he abhorred.
Sort of.
Later, after the strike. But before, he actually made the comment, apropos of what Bill is saying, where he said, this is like Jesus Christ communism, he said, looking at the studio. Now, what he didn't insert into that is that he was the Jesus Christ. And that was the resentment. You know, I say in the book that the studio did not operate like any other studio. It operated as if it were a cult. And Walt Disney was the Jim Jones of that cult. And until the strike, it did function as a cult. But after the strike, Walt lost his status as the cult figure.
In a very interesting way, it appeared to me as this moved through that what he had done was to give away the joys of creativity and turned it into a factory.
It did, but I'll tell you, it happened, I think, against Walt's resistance. There's a very interesting point in the history of the studio where the studio exists to make animations, obviously, and then the animations exist so that the studio can be maintained. When the studio crosses over, Walt is helpless. He is the prisoner of the studio, the prisoner of the scale of the operation.
All of which bears his name.
All of which bears his name. And Walt, when he makes Disneyland, when he begins to create Disneyland, what does he do? He creates a very small entity, a kind of boutique within the studio, Wed Enterprises, in an attempt to get back to the way it used to be in the early days before the studio was big, because Walt hated corporatism. He hated that scale. He wanted something small and intimate, and he was always searching for it. But of course, nothing succeeds like success, and nothing exceeds like excess, as they say in Scarface. So here he was creating a very successful enterprise that ultimately doomed the things that Walt loved about the enterprise.
We're going to be back in a moment, so I don't have to interrupt the next thing I want to talk about with Neil Gabler, who has written Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Mr. Gabler, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, invite you to return in a moment.